This is Attack of the 20th Century. Thank you for joining us as we explore science fiction, fantasy, and horror films of the 20th century. I'm your host, Jeff.
And I'm your other host, Kim.
Welcome to episode 35, where we review 1997's I Know What You Did Last Summer. Look for us on Instagram and Facebook at Attack of the 20th Century. That's 20th. We post our next movie selection there. You can comment, give your thoughts, and they just might make it on the air. Well, we were struck with a little bit of misfortune this week. True. If you remember, originally, we were going to be in West Virginia all this week celebrating the land of John Denver.
Wait, what? That's not the land of John Denver.
He sings about it, I guess, right? So
he does. I have a bone to pick with that, but we won't get into that. This is a different podcast.
Yeah, my whole family is from West Virginia. My mom, my dad, my grandparents, aunts and uncles, a bunch of cousins.
Right.
We were going to go see my grandfather, who's going to turn 102 in August.
Yeah.
Which is really exciting. But we were going to go a little early because it just fit in our schedule better. But we had some misfortune bestow upon us. What was that?
Yes, the flu found us. Apparently the flu, I don't know if this is unique to Florida or if it's happening everywhere, but the flu has hit a lot of people we know in mm-hmm. June. I don't know. Is this a post-COVID world? Like the flu hits us in June? That seems rare, right? Or just weird.
It is weird. We did do a COVID test and everybody was fine.
It's not COVID. Yeah. So, and we do know people personally that have tested positive for like the influenza.
Yeah.
Here in the last few weeks. But I don't know. Our kids didn't get tested. It was the kids. The kids got sick. All three kids have been sick. So we've been home. We decided not to take the flu to West Virginia, which was probably a wise decision.
They appreciate it, I'm sure.
Yes. And so we've stayed home.
Yeah. And that's fine. We postponed. We're going to go later this summer, so we'll get to go enjoy our time there. But
we do love to see West Virginia in the summer.
So we haven't watched much together lately. What is something you've been watching separately from me?
Okay, well, I think this is going to tie in interestingly to today's conversation, but I have been hankering for a good British like murder mystery, which is something that I do like. In its season for whatever reason. And so I went back and watched Whitechapel, which I think came out, it was a series done by the BBC. I want to say in 2012 is when they started. There's only four seasons. And the first couple of seasons, there's like three episodes a season, and that's it.
Okay.
I think the last two seasons, there may have been like five or six episodes. But I've been having to, you know, I'm teaching again this coming fall, and so I've been kind of plowing through some Latin curriculum. And so when I need a brain break, this is what I've been going to kind of watch little by little. So anyhow, it's a pretty dark, obviously it's set in 2012, so it's a little more modern, but it's set in Whitechapel, London, which is the Lower East End of London, which if you know anything about crime, drama, London folklore, that is the area of Jack the Ripper fame.
Yep.
So,
Saucy Jack.
Yeah. So it kind of, obviously it's not about Jack the Ripper because it's set in 2012, but there is kind of like, you know, you follow this detective who's got his own quirks, and I mean, it very much follows the Sherlock trope, right?
Yeah.
So he's kind of quirky. He has some issue. He's very OCD, and he's trying to make a name for himself as this lead detective. And there's some really weird, strange, dark murders that are happening in that section of London that he has to solve. So it was very well done. I really enjoyed it. There's, you know, if you're accustomed to watching a lot of British-made television shows, you'll see a lot of familiar faces.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's dark and...
What streaming service is it on?
Gosh, where did I watch it? I think I watched it on Amazon Prime.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's where I watched it.
What have I been watching? Really, I know we haven't talked a lot about this, but I watch The Price is Right pretty much daily.
Yes, you do. Because if you didn't know, we're actually 87. We sound like we're in our 40s, but he watches Price is Right and I watch Jeopardy.
And let's be clear, we're not talking modern day Drew Carey.
Oh, no.
We're talking about the Barker era.
Bob Which Barker, honestly is the best era.
Yeah. I just love it. I have a great memory of during my elementary years, anytime I was sick, I would watch The Price is Right. Yes. That was like something I would do.
Exactly.
You know? And it was so special because number one, if you're homesick, you don't feel good anyway.
Right.
So what do you have to look forward to? Well, you know, I was home alone typically.
Right.
And I would watch TV and I knew I would get to watch The Price is Right. So it was like, it was a special deal to watch The Price is Right.
Right. Well, because then after The Price is Right, what came on? It was like all the soap operas, right?
Soaps, yeah.
So all you had to watch was Price is Right.
Right. And I want to say it was from 11 to 12 or 10 to 11, something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
And so then we get Pluto TV, throw in another plug for Pluto. They have 24/7 a station that's The Price is Right, the Barker era.
All day, every day.
Yes. And I just love it. I mean, I love it. Bob Barker, he's funny, he's silly, he's happy. You know, he'll make fun of the contestants. You know, if somebody does a spin on the big wheel that's real weak, he'll be like, no, come on. That was kind of a wimpy spin. Let's give it another go. You know, he'll say things that, like, today, I don't know. I don't see people talking and interacting with contestants the way he did back then.
Yeah. I mean, Drew Carey tries, right? Because he does the prices right now, but it's not the same.
I think, too, like, the COVID restrictions.
Oh,
you know,
sure.
If you, back in the day, pretty much any girl who was selected would go up and kiss Bob Barker on the cheek.
Right.
Like, it was just something they did, you know.
Right.
And then when they would win something, they would celebrate and give him a big hug or something.
Right.
Now, there's, like, 6 feet between Drew Carey and the contestants at all times.
Sure, sure.
It, you know, it's fine, but it just, I don't know, there's something, there's a different feel to it. I think, too, Drew Carey is just a different comedian than Bob Barker was.
Right, sure. He's not the same guy.
Yeah. You know, Bob Barker, too, he had that charisma. I think there was something to him, like, he was a really good-looking old guy.
That's true. I totally agree with that.
And then you could just tell, like, basically.
It's like debonair, right?
Debonair, yeah. He had some sophistication about him, but he was funny. He was still accessible, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So, I don't know. It's not something I would watch, like, hey, family, let's all get together. Let's sit down and watch The Price is Right.
Right.
It would be more of, like, I just want something to play.
Okay.
Just to turn off my brain for a few minutes.
Exactly. I'm going to tell on you. Like, I could be out mowing, and I come in, and you're on a lunch break, and The Price is Right. It's probably playing.
Yeah,
in the
that's
background.
Correct.
I could be out doing anything, running errands, mowing, whatever. And if I come home on your lunch break, Price is Right, probably.
It's probably
playing. Good chance it's playing.
Because it's one of those things you could jump in, you can watch 30 minutes, 40
sure.
minutes, and then break away.
Is it a little bit disparaging what the prices were in the 70s and the 80s versus what they are now, though?
Well, it is funny because, like, I think I'm really good at guessing prices from the 70s and 80s now from watching so much.
No.
And I have watched some episodes of the Drew Carey version, you know, recently, because it's still on from 11 to 12. And the prices are just astronomical now.
Yeah. Well, it's based in California. So already that's a higher price point than what we're getting here in Florida.
Yeah.
But then, it's 2022.
I think, too, like, I don't know, I get so much elation seeing somebody win a car. You know,
deal.
And the people on there don't look like they're, you know, I don't know how to say this eloquently, but they don't look like they're lawyers and doctors. You know?
Sure.
They're just like normal middle class income folks. And then they just get a car, they get a trip to Bermuda or something really cool.
Right.
And when they win it, they get so ecstatic. And I don't know, I'm grinning from ear to ear. I'm super happy. There's all this like goodness and positivity.
It is.
Happening.
It's very positive. It's the Ted Lasso of
game shows,
right? Yeah.
Because even if you lose, let's say you lose and then you get the
which is like classic now.
You still get to do the big wheel where you spin.
That's right.
And you could still make it into the Showcase Showdown.
That's true.
So what are we reviewing this week?
All right. Today we are reviewing I Know What You Did Last Summer. It's a 1997 horror flick. It is rated R. That's mostly for language. And if you don't like spoilers, here's your opt-out. Go ahead and hit pause now. Go watch the movie. Come back and join us later.
And it is on HBO Max right now. That's where we watched it.
Oh, okay. I didn't even know where we watched it.
Yep, that's where.
HBO Max. There you go. Okay, so what happens in I Know What You Did Last Summer? Well, we have four young friends that are celebrating their last July 4th before starting college and new life adventures when tragedy strikes. On a dark and twisty road, the foursome accidentally hit a pedestrian. In a panic, the group decides to dump the body and cover up what they have done. A year goes by, and our four friends find themselves back in their seaside hometown for the summer. But someone begins leaving not-so-cryptic messages stating, "I know what you did last summer."
Title drop.
Believing that someone is seeking revenge for their misdeeds of the previous summer, the foursome find themselves hunted by a creepy fisherman with a deadly hook.
Ooh. This film was commercially successful. It grossed $125 million worldwide on a budget of only $17 million.
Wow, okay.
It was the number one film in the United States for three consecutive weeks.
Are you serious?
Yes.
Wow.
Very successful. It was loosely based on the 1973 novel of the same name by Lois Duncan.
Huh.
Little research there. That book didn't have any murder.
Oh.
It was kind of like an A-Team or a Scooby-Doo type murder mystery. Like, there wasn't actually murder.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So she did not like this film. She did not like how it turned out.
Lois Duncan.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
She was upset with all the graphic, you know, murders, which, like you just said, there really wasn't a lot of graphic murders in this.
No.
But it's all implied. I mean, it obviously happens.
Yeah, you don't see a lot. I mean, there is some gore, but as a slasher movie goes, from what I understand, because we all know that I am not the slasher movie connoisseur.
Right.
This is very unslashery for a slasher movie.
This movie very much could have been PG-13 if they didn't say the F-bomb so many times.
Yeah, there's some cursing in here, I guess, that makes this have the R rating, right?
A lot of them were like a scary image of a fisherman with a hook and him about to hit or something like that. But they don't show the blood. They don't show it like embedded in the skull and like...
Right, it's not super...
spewing out or anything.
Gory. Yeah, you're gorier now than the movie is.
Yeah, it is true. So the screenwriter wrote the script for Scream.
Okay, same guy.
Same guy.
Okay.
And he had been shopping this around, hadn't had any luck. Did get Scream, obviously, turned into a mega hit.
Right, that was
huge. A year
or
so earlier. And then, of course, you know how Hollywood is. They get something that's financially successful, they say, "Oh, we need more of this."
Right. This made money. Keep then, doing it.
So they grabbed the same guy. "What else you have?" "Well, I have a script that's awesome. It's ready to go right here."
Okay,
"I Know What You
so
Did Last Summer."
Back up. He wrote "I Know What You Did Last Summer" before he wrote Scream.
Correct.
Couldn't get anybody to bite for "I Know What You Did Last Summer."
Yes.
But Scream was huge. So then they were like, "Yeah, whatever else you got, give it to us."
Yep.
Interesting.
This was ready to go. So they started filming pretty quickly. And there you go. It was a big success.
Sure.
Now, did you mention the Rotten Tomatoes score on this one?
I have not mentioned it yet. It's not great.
Yeah.
So the audience score is a 40%.
Uh-huh.
And the tomato meter, the critic score, is 43%. So that's a pretty solid consensus there.
Right.
And it ain't great.
I have a theory on this. Because we'll get into how we felt about the movie and all that.
Right.
But sometimes you are a victim of your predecessor's success.
Oh, sure.
I'll give you a good example. The Others.
Oh, right.
It followed a year or so after The Sixth Sense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
No spoilers there, but there are some similarities between these two movies.
For sure.
Dealing with the dead, mm-hmm. and like when you're watching the film, like what you're seeing, perceiving, and what's really happening.
Right.
There are definitely some similarities between these two movies.
Yes, yes.
But if you watch The Others in and of itself, it's a great film.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But there was so much, you know, negativity thrown on it because it was considered a copycat film.
Oh.
And I do think I Know What You Did Last Summer is victimized a little bit by the success of Scream. So this film does draw inspiration from a couple of 1980s slasher films, Prom Night and The House on Sorority Row.
Never saw either one of those.
Yes, maybe we'll have to
oh, no.
watch those together.
This is not my genre.
But yeah, so as far as where it was filmed, you know, from the beginning of the film, it was actually in California, which we called. You and I said,
yeah,
this doesn't look like North Carolina.
Because it's supposed to be set in North Carolina, but yeah. It does not look like North Carolina.
Right.
We're not that far away from North Carolina. We drive through North Carolina almost every summer.
Yeah.
Doesn't look like that.
Right. But then, actually, we thought, too, you know, a lot of the fishermen scenes, we thought might be the Northeast, because it kind of looks like Maine or someplace like that. But a lot of that stuff was actually shot in North Carolina.
Okay. Okay.
So this film had two movie sequels and a TV series in 2019 and 2020 on Amazon Prime, consisting of 8 episodes.
I did not know that.
I know. I looked it up a little bit. Yeah. I didn't watch the series, but it had mostly negative reviews.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know.
Well, but I'm like assuming you said, since we haven't really heard of it, it must not have been great.
Yeah. But like you said, the original movie had negative reviews, but they still had 2 sequels.
Right, exactly. So, and it still made a ton of money.
Yeah. So when did you first see this film? We talked about the last episode that this is actually a different kind of situation where you've seen the movie and I haven't.
That's right. You had never seen this. So I actually saw this when it came out in 1997 in the theater,
wow.
which I know is way out of my box. But, you know, I graduated high school in 97, started college in the fall of 97, and I think came out in the fall of 97, right? So
right.
I went to see this with college friends. Like, this was not my choice, but people were going to the movies, and I was like, yeah, I'll go to the movies.
You were along for the ride.
And I had seen Scream, which scared the bejesus out of me.
Yeah.
But I knew it was in the same vein, and I think I went with the same group of people that I went to see Scream with. So,
yeah.
You know, it was like, they're into this. Sure, I'm along for the ride.
Yeah.
So I was a lot less discerning than I am now. So I saw it as I would have been 18.
What were your first impressions then?
I did not think it was as good as Scream then, even when I saw it, you know.
Okay.
This is not my genre. Even
did you think
then,
it was a ripoff?
I didn't feel like it was a ripoff. It just felt like it was the same kind of movie. But again, I was not a connoisseur of slasher movies. Like mm-hmm. as a younger kid, I was the kid at the slumber party who's like, you know, y'all are going to watch Jason or Freddy. I'm out. I'm going to go in here and talk to your grandma. You know, like I don't want to watch this junk, you know? So this was kind of new for me watching Scream and then watching I Know What You Did Last Summer. And I saw the sequel to I Know What You Did Last Summer.
See, I haven't seen that one.
Whenever that came out, I remember nothing about it now, but I know I saw it. Anyhow, so this was all kind of new to me. I probably did a lot of watching between my fingers, you know?
Yeah.
Hands over my face.
Yeah.
I just remember thinking, like, there were jump scares, yes, but it didn't seem as scary or as well done as Scream. And
okay.
That's really all I remember of it.
Okay.
Even when we watched it this weekend, I was like, I'm struggling to remember how this plays out.
I even asked you, do you know who the killer is?
And I was like, no.
You didn't know. So it was like watching it all over again.
Yeah, a little bit.
Brand new. First time I saw it was this weekend with you. We had a laptop on our laps and watched it in bed late at night.
Perfect end of the night movie.
And we did say, you know what? Like, it's funny because a lot of the movies we pick are a little creepier.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much scary. You know, a lot of them are older. And this one, I think as far as scary movies go, this one's definitely a lightweight compared to what you really could watch for a scary movie.
I'm sure it is, but this is, you know, enough. It's enough for me.
It was enough for enough. All right, well, let's go through some of the cast and some of the personnel involved here. It was directed by Jim Gillespie. And I looked at his IMDb. He's only directed 5 films total.
Really? Okay.
So I was a little shocked that even though this was so successful, he didn't have a ton of work after this.
That's weird.
So Jennifer Love Hewitt plays Julie James in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And she's what they consider the final girl.
Okay.
So if you're not a horror connoisseur, that's usually the case where there's a bad guy on the loose.
Right.
And there's some girl at the very end that's like just trying to survive.
Sure. Like Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween.
Yeah. And that's the prototype.
Okay.
Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween.
Oh, okay.
You know, what do you think of when you think of Jennifer Love Hewitt?
I know she was big in Party of Five. I never watched Party of Five,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, I know she, you know, and then she did the Ghost Whisperer after this, right?
Yes. And you know, I've seen some episodes
I've seen
of that.
A few episodes, pretty hokey, you know.
Yeah.
Like.
Right.
I wanted to be into it, but it was a little on the hokey side.
When she was a kid, she was in Kids Incorporated.
Oh my gosh, yes. I forgot all about
We're
Kids Incorporated.
We're big Mystery Science Theater fans, and she was in a movie that they covered this year. I'm trying to remember what it's called, but it's not Gremlins, but it's some sort of...
It's something like that.
Something like that, yeah. But yeah, she's in that as a kid. Of course, she was in Garfield, which was probably her biggest financial success.
Really?
And then she won a Golden Globe Award for her part in a show called The Client List.
I've heard of The Client List, but I never saw it.
Never saw it either. But yeah. So Jennifer Love Hewitt, we all know her. She was... So even though I hadn't seen this film, I was very much familiar with Jennifer Love Hewitt.
She was
a sex symbol when we were kids, right?
Yeah.
Sarah Michelle Gellar mm-hmm. plays Helen Shivers. She, of course, is from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Thing.
Yes, I was a fan of that.
Yeah.
I didn't watch the show as much. The movie, my sister and I were big Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie fans.
Okay.
We didn't really watch the show a ton.
My sister
and Sarah Michelle Gellar's from the show, right? Not
yeah,
from
yeah,
the
from the show.
Yeah.
My sister was a huge Buffy fan.
Okay.
And then, of course, in Scooby-Doo, I think she played, not Velma, who was the pretty one? Daphne,
yeah.
She plays Daphne.
Yes.
She was in Scream 2. She was in Cruel Intentions. And then Ryan, what's his name?
Felipe.
He plays Barry Cox. In this movie, he's kind of like the jock.
He is, which is, I have bones to pick with that. Like, he doesn't seem super believable as a jock to me. Like, he's supposedly going away to college to be a football player. And, like, I don't know. That seems unrealistic, but whatever. Maybe he's a kicker. I don't know.
He definitely, when you think of the word privileged, he is that guy. Yeah, he is that
in this movie, for sure.
I only know him from Cruel Intentions.
I never saw that.
Freddie Prinze Jr. plays mm-hmm. Ray Bronson.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hear that name one time in the movie, I don't think. Maybe Ray.
I just saw your notes where his name is Ray Bronson. I'm like, his name was Ray in the movie?
I never would have guessed that.
You know what I remember? Billy Blue. That's literally the only
Billy
thing
Blue,
I remember.
He was in She's All That, which I never saw.
No, actually, I think I did see She's All That, but I forgot he was in it.
And then, of course, the Scooby-Doo movies.
Yeah.
He plays Fred.
Yeah, which is... Because I've seen that and I know that, then now watching this again, it was like that's all I could see him as was Fred from Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, yeah. Bridget Wilson or Bridget Wilson Sampras plays Elsa Shivers.
Uh huh.
Of course, she married Pete Sampras. We're big tennis fans. We're big Pete Sampras fans.
Yeah.
And the story there is like he was watching a movie, sees this gorgeous actress, and he's like hanging out with another actor watching the movie.
Yeah.
And says, man, I really wish I could meet this girl. And he's like, oh, Bridget? I know Bridget. You know, I can give you her number. And yeah, like,
wow.
He called her. They just, I don't know, things really clicked and they got married.
And they're still together, right?
They're still together, yeah. Okay.
Awesome. Well, good for Pete Sampras.
She was in Mortal Kombat.
Yes, I do
Sonya.
Remember that.
Sonya Shi. Billy Madison.
This could be our milk.
Yeah. And then House on Haunted Hill. Those are movies that we know her from.
I've never seen House on Haunted Hill.
She's super gorgeous, like kind of a Barbie doll-like face, right?
Yeah, yeah, Barbie doll-like, that blonde bombshell kind of thing.
Anne Hesh plays Melissa Missy Egan.
Egan. Mm-hmm. I think they say Egan in the movie.
She starred in Volcano, Wag the Dog, which was a movie you and I enjoyed. Mm-hmm. That was a good one.
Mm-hmm.
The Psycho remake, which I really don't remember her at all, but she plays the Janet Leigh character. Muse Watson plays Ben Willis, the actual killer, you know, the fisherman.
Oh, yeah, okay.
He was in Prison Break. I don't know if you remember him from Prison Break.
I do not. I'll have to... You don't really get a good shot of his face until the very end of this movie.
Yeah.
So it's not, like, ingrained in my memory. I am was a huge Prison Break fan.
Yeah.
So I'll have to go back and
You
look.
Used to watch it religiously.
I did. I loved Prison Break. Wentworth Miller, where are you?
Yeah. We need you, Wentworth.
That's right. Come back to us.
What a cool name, too. Wentworth?
Yeah.
That's
he has a British parent, I believe.
Does he?
That's... I mean, we have a kid named Stratford because I love all things British.
Yeah.
So.
Johnny Galecki. Of course, he plays Max.
Yes, which we know from Roseanne, right?
Roseanne.
That's where I know him from. And The Big Bang Theory, which he's probably more famous for The Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
But I watched Roseanne as a kid, and he is from Roseanne.
He is. And then if you're a fan of Christmas Vacation, he plays Russ.
Oh, I forgot he was in Christmas Vacation.
Right. Why don't we get into standouts? This is where we talk about just the big highlights of the film, you know, things that make it stand out. And one thing that it's undeniable about this movie is between this film and Scream, it helped revitalize the slasher genre.
Okay. See, I didn't realize that. Like, because I wasn't following the slasher genre, I didn't watch that stuff.
Well, you figure in the 80s, of course, you just mentioned Freddy and Jason. Of course, you had Michael Myers and Halloween. That was huge in the late 80s to late 70s to mid 80s.
Okay.
That was huge. And it kind of went cold for a while.
Oh, okay.
So then you're talking here, it's like mid to late 90s, it kicks back up.
Gotcha. So what were we doing for scary movies in the meantime before Scream comes back? Did we have scary
movies? What I want to think of is movies like Copycat, where it was a little closer to what you would see in like NCIS or something like true crime type stuff.
Okay, like Hand the Rocks a Cradle, Sleeping with the Enemy, that sort of. Now, see, I'm into those. I watched those quite a bit growing up, actually.
Kind of those psychological, like true crime type.
I think that's the cutoff for me. Like, I'm more of a psychological thriller and less of a slasher.
Yeah, no, I get it. Another standout I'll throw out are the jump scares in this movie were very effective.
Yeah, they were. Okay, they got me here. Yeah.
So there's a few I'm going to throw out, right? The teens are attempting to dispose of this body. So they hit this body with a car. Mm-hmm. They think it's dead. They even check for a pulse and say this guy's dead.
But they're teenagers and one of them is very drunk.
Yeah.
So I'm like, really? Like that we're going to trust your ability to check for a pulse?
Right.
I don't know.
But, you know, we assume as the viewer, like, all right, this guy's dead. You know, right before they throw him in the water. And they go through a lot of trouble to get him to throw him in the trunk of the car. They drive down to the waterfront.
Which, honestly, that's their downfall, right? Like, they're on basically a cliff where they hit the guy on this twisty road in the dark.
Yeah.
But they choose to put him in the trunk of their car, drive him back down to the dockside, and then dump his body there. Like, why? Why? That's too many steps.
Yeah.
You're asking for a problem.
You're asking for a problem. Well, they're not very bright teenagers.
No, they're not.
So they're about to dump him into the water, and he like comes alive and grabs him, and it's like, ah! It's a huge jump scare.
It is. Oh, wait. Well, the best part of that is one, Sarah Michelle Gellar's character is like, she's not the prom queen. Maybe she was the prom queen, but she just won like some sort of beauty pageant, 4th of July thing. She's that person in this movie. And she's still, even though all this drama is happening, she's still wearing her crown from the pageant earlier in the night. So he grabs her crown as he's like falling into the water. Right?
Yeah. So they know they have to do something because if this dead guy shows up with her crown, it's, you know,
that's trouble.
And so there's another scene where the jock character, Barry, he jumps in to go retrieve the crown.
That's right.
And when he's trying to grab it, this guy that's been hit, his eyes pop open.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another like, you know, the music cues like, bah!
Yeah.
Right when the
that's
eyes pop
trope,
open.
That's a trope though, right? Like you... I feel like we see that in a lot of movies where you think someone's dead. I mean, we even see this in The Land Before Time, right?
Yeah.
You think Sharptooth is dead and then his eyes pop open. Well,
yeah.
Like, that's a thing.
Yeah, it's very much a thing. But still,
it gets you.
Another scene, and this is probably one of the most effective scenes. They go visit Anne Hesh's character, Missy. And, you know, they've deceived her. That whole scene is tense, and we'll talk about that
in
a few minutes.
It is. Creepy, yeah.
Creepy. And they go back to their car, and they're kind of waiting, you know, they're talking through things. And then Missy, when she shows up, she, like, slaps her hand against the window.
She pops up out of nowhere.
Just pops out of nowhere in the car. Like, That about made me like jump out of bed. Yeah. Like I told you, we watched this sit on a laptop in our bed. I was like, ah!
Where'd she come from?
So that was a very effective jump scare. Another really good one. You know, the fisherman, the killer, is right. chasing Sarah Michelle Gellar.
He's always in, I think they call it a slicker, like that big rubbery long coat that yeah. fishermen wear.
Yeah.
And then like the Mr. Gordon's hat, you know. Yeah. Mr. Gordon fisherman you yeah. buy fish sticks in the frozen section, that guy, right. he's always wearing that hat.
So Bridget Wilson Sampras, she plays Elsa. She's kind of minding the shop.
It seems
family.
Like a family department store or something.
And she's Sarah Michelle Gellar's character, her big sister.
Mm-hmm.
This is their shop. Sarah Michelle Gellar runs to that shop. She gets in. There's this whole, you know, sequence of events that happens. She's running away from the killer. And then she looks and she's looking at these mannequins. And the mannequins are covered with kind of like tulle. Kind
plastic.
Of like,
I think it's plastic. Like keep dust off. Like a dust cover.
Oh, okay. That's what it is. So they're covering the mannequin. Well, like when I was watching the movie, like I saw it. It's like, that's clearly the fisherman.
Yeah, the fisherman is one of the mannequins.
One of the fishermen. But, you know, she's staring at him and you're looking at him like as a POV shot.
Yeah.
And then he lunges towards her.
Yeah.
Very scary. That was a jump scare.
It was a good jump scare. It was.
And then one other jump scare scene I'll mention is the very final scene where she takes a shower. She comes out.
Jennifer Love Hewitt's character.
Jennifer, yeah. Thank you. Julie. She comes out, and there was actually, let me back up. There was actually like a false scare where she gets this note.
Oh, yeah.
And it's written in the exact same handwriting as what the killer had done with.
I Know What You Did Last Summer.
I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Right.
But this was like a false alarm because it was like some sort of party.
Yeah, it was like
party.
A sorority invite or something, I think.
Yeah. So she goes and takes a shower. And when she comes back, the mirror says, I still know.
Yeah. In the you know, whatever.
Kind of steam.
The steam. Yeah. The fog. The glass is fogged up and someone has clearly written with their finger, I still know.
And so she's looking at it like, oh, crap.
She's staring at, yeah, is it the mirror or the shower door? I think it's the shower door. She's
you
staring
might be
right. at it like, oh, no.
It's a piece of glass, yeah.
Yeah.
So she's staring at it, and the very final scene, like the killer lunges towards her, the glass breaks. That's a jump scare.
Yeah.
And then the movie is done, the credits roll.
Which I honestly, like, they could have done that as a 3D shot, right? Because it's the fisherman coming at the screen.
Yeah.
I wonder, I don't remember seeing that in 3D in the theater. I don't know if they did that. It was
probably
before
not.
The onslaught of all the 3D movies, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But that would have been a good one where the fisherman's, like, jumping into the audience. Because
yeah.
that's the POV of that shot. He's coming right at you.
And then, so I looked ahead. I haven't seen the second film, and I wondered, like, well, by this ending, you think, like, she's dead. Like, the fisherman's
got her. Yeah,
how are
they having a sequel? Because clearly, she's dead now, right?
Well, they explain it away as a dream sequence.
Yeah.
In the second film.
Okay, so this is how my memory functions or dysfunctions, is that I saw that ending scene with you the other night and thought, huh, I know I've seen the sequel, but now I really can't remember, like, so is she dead in the beginning of the sequel?
Right.
So, thankfully, you looked that up and reminded me, like, no, it's a dream sequence.
Yeah.
In the sequel. That makes sense. All right, so I do have a standout, though this is not my genre, and I'm not a slasher, I don't know, lover of slasher,
mm-hmm.
connoisseur, right. I do appreciate the mystery that was involved here. And I think they did an okay job of creating some mystery, some mystique here, some, you know, we're trying to figure things out.
Mm-hmm.
Right away in the opening scene, we have some guy sitting on like a cliff and he's clearly reflecting on the death of a girlfriend or something. You know, it's not really clear, but as the movie plays out, you realize like, oh, wait. And they really set it up so you think that that's the guy that they hit with their car,
yeah.
right? Like, is this guy that was out, he was drinking, he had mm-hmm. some kind of like charm in his pocket, he was reminiscing on some tragic event,
yeah.
and you think, okay, that's who they hit with their car. But as the movie unfolds, you start realizing, oh, wait, maybe that's not who they hit with their car. And so there's this really, there's this intrigue happening where you're trying to put the pieces together. And that is what I'm drawn into in a darker movie like this. Not the slasher aspect, but the mystery. The mystery. Yeah, exactly. We just didn't know who the killer was. Was it a ghost for the majority of the movie? Yeah. Is it a ghost seeking revenge? Is it this guy who was upset about the loss of a girlfriend?
Yeah.
You know, the thought that it could be the dad of the girlfriend coming that was killed in a car accident a year earlier, like there's a whole lot of twisty turniness there, right?
Yeah.
Like,
that didn't really become a possibility until the third act.
Right? Yeah, way late in the movie.
I agree. You're kind of thinking like, is this guy, did he survive? Because his eyes popped open underwater.
Right.
And then they left. So is it him?
Yeah, is it the guy who we saw early in the movie sitting on the cliff? Or is it
a ghost? A ghost of him?
Right. Is it a ghost of him? Did somebody survive? Or is it a paranormal event? You don't know. You really don't know until very late in the movie. So that's, I like the intrigue of that.
Mm-hmm.
You also get this whole Billy Blue angle, which they throw in. So when they go to visit, Jennifer Love Hewitt goes to visit Anne Hesh's character, who's the sister of the guy who you think that they've hit with their car. And so she gives them the story about somebody named Billy Blue that had gone to school with her brother, came to visit her after they found the body, you know, in a fishing net or whatever. And immediately, I mean, they spin it. I felt like even when I saw this the first time, it was like, wait a minute, Billy Blue, that's a stupid name. Like
nobody's really named Billy Blue.
Yeah, nobody's really named Billy Blue. Like somebody's spinning you a tale. And you don't, I do think Anne Hesh is perfect at her character because you really don't know. Is she unhinged?
Yeah.
She seems a little, she's creepy, crazy, a little creepy. She's obviously into taxidermy and like lives off by herself.
Yeah.
Her, you know, do we find out? I don't know if we know where the rest of her family is, but clearly her brother's been killed. You know, like there's just a lot going on there. And she sells it. She's very creepy. And we don't know what the deal is with Freddie Prinze. We finally see very close to the final act of the movie that Freddie Prinze's boat that he works off of is named Billy Blue. And you've got that moment of like Jennifer Love Hewitt's character, Julie James, realizing like, Billy Blue, you're the killer. And she thinks Freddie Prinze Jr. is the bad guy in that moment. She's like, you're the guy who went to see the sister, you know, but then realizing like he's the one stuck back at home. He's been living in this town this whole time. So of course he just used a fake name and was trying to make sense of this whole ordeal, you know? So I don't know. They kept you guessing. It really was not apparent who the stalker murdery guy was until very late in the movie. So that I can respect.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I love about you personally, Kim, is you're brilliant.
Oh, thanks.
It's true. No, you're brilliant. You figure things out super early. Like you catch things way quicker than I catch them. And for this to have so many turns and stuff, like you didn't know who this was. Like there's no way for you to have really anticipated like, oh, this is the dad of the girl that was killed by this boyfriend.
No, it's pretty twisty turny, right? Yeah. Like there's a lot going there.
There's a lot going there. So I like that there's a lot of mystery to it. It kept you guessing. You're trying to figure it out as you go along. For sure.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned that Anne Hesh scene. This leads to my last standout. Is really there's this creepy factor.
Oh yeah.
And when they go visit Anne Hesh in her home, I felt very tense the whole time that they were there.
Oh, yeah. Honestly, that was probably the best acting of the movie, is Anne Hesh.
Yeah.
Actual acting.
That whole sequence, I think, is like the best part of the movie.
Yeah. Because
Jennifer Love Hewitt and Sarah Michelle Gellar are talking about Angela Lansbury.
Yeah.
And who was the other one? They did another reference.
I don't remember.
But they did this other. But basically, they're talking up front about going up to the. They're kind of scared,
right?
Because they're going to have to act.
Right.
These are teenage girls trying to act.
They're trying to figure out who's out to get them.
Yeah.
Right.
But they have to pretend like their car broke down and they're just coming to see. Like this could be a family member, because they hypothesize that this is a family member who's so upset with them.
Right.
That they're. You know, basically she's...
Somehow they know that they've killed their family member.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know if at this point we know that this person has killed people. But they're, you know, they're definitely like, because all four are still alive. The main
characters. Yeah, I think at this point, Max is missing.
Max is missing. Okay, yeah. That would make sense. Anyway, so that whole scene was very tense. And Anne Heche is just off. Like, she's just different, yeah. Quirky, weird. And you're like, she could be a killer.
Mm-hmm.
She's not a normal person.
No.
So, yeah, I think Anne Heche really could get a standout.
You know what those scenes remind me of? And I don't know if you've ever seen this. And now I'm trying to remember even the name of it. It was a Kevin Bacon movie. And he's like, is it Murder in the First, maybe?
Uh-huh.
Like all these backwoods people. There's these really creepy scenes. I'm sure there's other movies that do this too. But obviously, this is not my specialty. So, I don't know. But uh-huh. I know for a fact I've seen the Kevin Bacon movie. And every time I see this Anne Heche, you know, part play out, it just reminds me of that. Just really yeah. creepy backwoods, like these yeah. people probably eat their young. I don't know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like
there's something off.
Something is off and it's very creepy.
Right. No, I get it. And some of the other like creepy factors of this film that I love, the killer, you know, he goes up Sarah Michelle Gellar's character, her up the stairs, and she yeah. just misses seeing him walk up the stairs.
Yep, exactly.
And you, as an audience member, you're like, don't
you
go up
know,
there.
Yeah, you know he's upstairs, but she doesn't see it.
Like, yeah, the devil is up there. You're walking up there to see this devil, you know.
Yeah, don't go up there.
And he hides in the closet, and she goes to sleep mm-hmm. with him in her closet. So it's just really, really creepy. She wakes up with her hair has been like chopped up. She's.
Oh, yes. She's like a blonde Barbie doll, right? So yeah. like she's got this long blonde hair. So this is devastating to her to wake up and her hair's been all. She's going to have to bob it off, you know.
Yeah.
As someone who's lived with bobbed hair 99% of my life, I'm like, oh, get over yourself. But whatever.
But still, I think the fact that somebody cut your hair while you were asleep.
That's creepy.
That's really creepy.
That is very
so
creepy.
So she wakes up, and plus she went to sleep not wearing this crown.
That's true. She woke up with the crown back on her head.
Yes.
And her hair's like, it's like her hair's falling out, which I do think is a recurring nightmare for a lot of women. Like you dream about this, like why is my hair falling out? Why is my hair falling out? It's probably different now that COVID yeah. has happened, and I think a lot of people are losing their hair, but right. whatever. She wakes up and like just chunks of her hair is just like she's pulling away, like what is yeah. happening, and she realized someone has chopped up her hair while she was sleeping.
And she had been the beauty pageant winner the year before. That very night she was going to have to go and
pass her crown off.
So yeah, there's just a lot going on. I think that was super creepy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a fan of Halloween, there is this scene where the killer is stalking
the movie,
Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Not the holiday.
Yeah, that's right. Or maybe both. Either.
Oh, sure.
Either
sure.
or. But no, in the movie Halloween, you know, Michael Myers is not, like, he doesn't sprint towards his victims.
Right, okay.
It's like a slow kind of stalk.
Yeah.
And that's what this murderer does, the guy that's wearing a
that's
a
true.
Outfit.
Yeah, he's not moving at, like, the weird zombie speed we see in other movies.
So that scene where she runs towards the department store that her family owns, her sister's there, the door is locked, she's mm-hmm. trying to get in. You know, Sarah Michelle Gellar's, like, pulling at the door, hurry, hurry, hurry!
Open the door!
Open the door! And then, you know, Bridget Wilson, like, walks towards there, and she's like, oh, no, I forgot the keys.
Right.
She turns around and goes and gets the keys. The whole time you're seeing the killer like walk pretty slowly.
Yeah, he's not in a hurry,
which
just it makes the paranoia and the angst that much more palpable, right?
Yeah. It's definitely a powerful scene, and not to say that this movie's nearly on the par with Halloween the movie,
right? Sure.
But it was reminiscent. I thought that was very good.
Okay.
And then, you know, the look of the killer.
Oh,
I'll
yeah,
I'll throw a stand out there. I thought the look of the killer, like, it was different, you know, like
the fisherman with the hook.
The fisherman with the hook.
It sticks with you. And I love, it's just very ghost story reminiscent. And they even do a little homage to this in the beginning of the movie when the four friends are on the beach and they're, you know, they're kind of trying to retell the ghost story that we've all heard around a campfire somewhere about the hook-handed man and the woman drove away and the next morning she found the hook on her car. You know, like they all have their different spin on that story. And this guy is like the embodiment of that ghost story that we've all heard some version of in our childhood, right? So it definitely sticks with you. Like there's a, when you think, if you've seen I Know What You Did Last Summer and you think of that movie, you think of the fisherman with the hook, right?
Right,
like it just, they did a really good job of sealing that image in your mind.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, now we get into setbacks. Things that, you know, probably aren't the best, right, for this film.
Yes, exactly.
Why don't you get us started? What's a setback you can think of?
Well, I do think, I know why they picked the actors they picked. He'd already made a ton of money on Scream, and that was Drew Barrymore and some other, a couple other big names, right?
Yeah.
So then these, Freddie Prinze Jr. and Sarah Michelle Gellar and Jennifer Love Hewitt, like they were hot on the kind of the teen scene, college scene at yeah. that time. So I get why they picked them, but the acting was pretty sophomoric here.
Yeah.
Right? Like this was not... It was not the birds. This was not, you know, yeah. like it was just meh. There's a lot of cheesy romantic lines. We've got these, yeah. you know, they must have just graduated. They're seniors. They're all about to go off to college. There's some cheesy romantic scenes on the beach there. It just meh as yeah. far as acting goes. Yeah. yeah. Like we said earlier, like I think the strongest acting here came from Anne Hesh in just a, you know, a side scene, basically.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think. You're right. I mean, I think slasher films in general aren't known for great acting.
Oh, that's true.
I think it's fine for this film, but you're right. Like, especially at the end, I think there's this interlude between Hewitt and Prince that, like, I don't know. It was real cringy, right?
Yeah. Are you talking about the shower scene at the end when she...
No, even before that. You know, right after the police had shown up and stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Right after they... He's like, well, they don't catch the killer, but...
No one gets me like you do. You know, there yeah. was something along
that
line.
That was a throwback to the conversation they had earlier, but it was real cheesy.
It was cheesy.
Yeah, it was super cheesy.
You know, another setback I'll throw out, it felt a little MTV-esque.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So it had this big movie soundtrack, which clearly back in the 90s, if you don't know, you know, and I'm sure it was true of the 80s and the 70s as well. But
probably.
They're pushing the movie soundtrack as much as they're pushing the movie.
Oh, yeah. How many soundtracks did we own back in the CD era, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We owned a lot of movie soundtracks.
And I don't really think that's a thing now. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. You know, we're not really current, right?
No, we're not.
But this was a big movie soundtrack. It had acts like Offspring, L7, Toad the Wet Sprocket, mm-hmm. Soul Asylum. So if you were from the 90s, like these were bands that were on the radio. It was a big deal.
Yeah. And I heard a criticism of this. Like obviously when you watch this movie, you're in the 90s.
Yeah.
Like that soundtrack takes you right. It feels like a 90s music video a lot yeah. of the time. But I heard that, and I don't remember because it's been so long since I've seen Scream, and maybe we need to watch Scream. I don't know that I want to, but maybe we need to rewatch it.
Add it to the list.
That the Scream soundtrack did not go that route. It did okay. not do a fully 90s popular band soundtrack.
Okay.
And so it's got more of that timeless quality to it. Whereas this one is like, oh, this is clearly a 90s teen flick.
Yeah.
Because yeah. it feels like an MTV set list.
Yeah. But, you know, I think this movie suffers a little bit. And we've talked about this before. We talked about it with Omega Man,
mm-hmm.
where you have a soundtrack that's very much of the time.
So rooted in its era.
It yeah. dates the movie a little bit.
It dates it. Yeah.
So I think, you know, when you're watching this movie, you're kind of like, okay, well... This is very much a mid to late 90s movie.
Right. You know? I think our oldest son would be proud of us now if we can, you know, because we're going to say orchestral music is where it's at.
Yeah.
That's what makes your movie more timeless.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't know if you can hear that. I'm pounding my fist.
She's pounding her fist.
Like, yeah. I mean, you can't, if you put music of the time in your movie, however cool and chic it may be at the moment, it's not going to work in 5 years. It's not yeah. going to work in 10 years.
Yeah. And just to kind of piggyback off what you said, the kind of the weakness of the cast a little bit, I really felt like the girls were much stronger than the guys.
Oh, yes. Yes, 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 yes.
I think Sarah Michelle Gellar didn't do anything wrong. I think she did the most that she could with this movie.
Yeah.
You mentioned Anne Hesh. Great. I think Jennifer Love Hewitt did fine. I mean, it didn't bother me at all, like her acting performance. But
she
it was really,
is who she is, yeah.
You know, Ryan, what's his name, Filippi?
Filippi? I don't know, whatever.
You know, was he the best choice for a jock in a movie? Probably not. I mean, I felt like he did fine, though. Like,
I think you nailed it when you said, like, the word privilege, like that is his character.
Yeah.
Like that sums it all up right there. Yeah.
But really Freddie Prinze Jr. I think was kind of out of his league. I know.
Yeah. And they tried, I think their intent was to paint him as like, he was the kid from the other side of the tracks.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and he's, you know, like comes from the poorer family and he's more grounded, but they just didn't sell it.
Yeah.
You know, like it
didn't seem important at all.
He had one little like speech where he's like, I don't have what you guys have, blah, blah, blah. And it was just so like, okay, we see what you're doing. It was too much. It was just very on the nose. Like, okay, so he's supposed to be the kid who's grounded, comes from the rougher side of town, has a poor family background, you know.
Right.
I don't know. It was too on the nose.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I thought he was kind of the weak point. And then for him to be like the saving guy at the end, the one that saves the final girl.
Yeah. He's the one that survives. Right. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's another setback for me is why did we kill Max?
Yeah.
Like that doesn't make sense to me. He wasn't there. He wasn't part of like, you know, the conspiracy of almost murdering the pedestrian. Like, I don't know. But here's what I heard. I did a little digging and a little listening.
Okay. Sleuth work here?
So when they did the first run of this movie in front of the test groups, it wasn't slashery enough for the people who were looking for a slasher movie. So they added in Max's murder.
Okay.
To be like, okay, well, here's a murder. You know, people that are looking for a slasher flick.
Yeah.
Here's a murder. So they added that in after the fact. And it just doesn't make sense to me.
So this isn't unheard of.
Oh, really?
I really like the John Carpenter film, The Fog.
Uh-huh.
And you watched a little bit of that with me.
Yeah.
The very beginning, or not the very beginning, but the first act, you know, the guys that are out on the boat, there's three dudes that are just kind of out on a joyride, getting away from their families for a little while.
Right.
And they get killed, like, pretty graphically. And it reminds me of this movie, actually. You get, like, fisherman people with a hook.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
Stabbing people. And they added that in just to add some gore.
Yeah.
Because that's like, all right, this is a slasher film. You need some more murder. You need some more blood.
Yeah.
And some grossness.
And I think that's other people's, you know, setback for this movie, too, is it's not slashery enough to be a slasher film. It's fine for me. I'm okay.
Yeah. You're okay with it?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, the jump scares is enough to call it a slasher film for me.
Yeah.
But I get it. Like, if you're going for a slasher film, I guess this doesn't hit the mark.
Yeah.
But,
let me ask you, how did you, you know, when we talked through the cast a little bit, we already talked about Freddie Prinze Jr. pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Jennifer Love Hewitt, how did you think she did in this movie?
She's fine. I've never been a huge fan of her. Like, I don't have any dings against her, but I don't think I've ever really seen her in anything that I was like, wow, she's amazing. You know, I will say what I think one of the other major setbacks for this movie is of these four main characters, there's nothing really likable about them. They are like cliche teenage meh.
Yeah.
You know, like she's clearly like the valedictorian, never does anything wrong kind of person.
Yeah.
Freddie Prinze Jr., like we already said, he's the other side of the tracks guy who's good at heart, you know, whatever. Ryan Phillippe's character is the jock, but privileged, doesn't care about anybody else. He's going to take care of himself. And Sarah Michelle Gellar is that, you know, just
beauty
pretty
pageant winner.
Beauty pageant, Barbie doll type character that everything is going well for. And honestly, the funny thing to me is that Jennifer Love Hewitt is kind of sold as the main character here. And she survives to go on and do the sequel.
The final girl.
But you get like 27 minutes or more in this movie where it's just Sarah Michelle Gellar and you don't even see Jennifer Love Hewitt.
Yeah.
So I'm like, who is the main character here?
No, I heard a lot about that, like the criticisms. Like,
really?
Why wasn't Sarah Michelle Gellar the final girl? Because she seemed like the better actress.
Yeah.
Like, a better character in this movie. Like, you know, she's more solid, you know?
Well, and she actually has a more rounded character, I feel like. There's this tension with her and her sister who clearly is like keeping up the family business, doing things that she needs to do. And Sarah Michelle Gellar has this like, I want to go to New York. I want to be an actress. But, you know, yeah. whatever. There's a tension there at least that's,
right.
you know, which Jennifer Love Hewitt has none of that.
We have no backstory on
her,
really. We
have no backstory. We see her mom for like 2 seconds in the movie yeah. and that's it. We don't know any of the rest of her family story. There's nothing to anchor us in her character.
Yeah.
Or at least Sarah Michelle Gellar has this tension with her sister. We know she's the pageant queen. We know she wants to go be an actress. And we know that that doesn't happen for her because when Jennifer Love Hewitt comes home from her first year of college, Sarah Michelle Gellar is still in the hometown working in the family store.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of, I feel like there's a mismatch there.
Yeah.
You know, Sarah Michelle Gellar probably should have been our main person.
And I think a lot of that has to do with star power. At that point, Jennifer Love Hewitt, I think, was the bigger name. Like
sure.
She, and, you know, Sarah Michelle Gellar obviously would go on to be Buffy and
yeah.
have some other roles that kind
of... Was this kind of the first place we see Sarah Michelle Gellar?
I think so. I mean, you know, I'm sure she had some acting credits before that, but she wasn't as notable as Jennifer Love Hewitt
right.
at this point.
Well, Jennifer Love Hewitt started in Kids Incorporated. Come
yeah.
on.
And then Party of Five, you know, they were trying to pull in some teenage
yeah.
crowd there.
I was never into... Did you watch Party of Five?
No.
I didn't either. I don't know. I just missed
Even
out
if
on
if I
that.
Did, I wouldn't admit it, but no, I didn't watch it.
I don't know. It's like one of those... I don't know. I don't know what my niche is, but it wasn't that because there's a lot of ladies my age that mm-hmm. are like, oh, Gilmore Girls, oh, Party of Five.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I never saw any of that.
I did see some Gilmore
That's
Girls.
A whole different thing.
Yeah. I did see some of those episodes, I think with you.
Well, I tried to watch it like just a few years ago. I tried yeah. to like, okay, all my mom friends are like, oh, we can finally watch Gilmore Girls with our daughters. And then I was like, no, I'm not. I tried yeah. to watch a few episodes. I was like, this is not my
me.
Jam.
Yeah.
No, thanks. Sorry, friends that love Gilmore Girls.
Gores.
Oh, my gosh. We're turning this into a horror flick.
Yeah, we're definitely in the horror mode.
All
right.
Somebody that's a producer out there, Gilmore Gore. That's yeah. where you need to take
that's, yeah.
And that's not even my scene, but whatever. So anyhow, I love you all that love Gilmore Girls, but sorry.
Not your jam.
Not my jam.
Well, so a couple things, you know, that I wanted to bring up. You know, one was, so they had these big plans that they're going to dump this body.
Sure.
And move on. And this is a little bit of a trope in movies that, you know, it never really works out.
Of course not.
The idea is that, like, we, you know, if you remember, all of them were on the trajectory of positivity and success.
Right. We've got Sarah Michelle Gellar's going off to New York to become an actress. Valedictorian Jennifer Love Hewitt's going to, something to become a lawyer or something.
Yeah.
Like, she wants to go to school in the Northeast. Jock kid, Ryan Phillippe, he's going to be a quarterback somewhere.
Yeah.
I don't know. And then I guess I'm not really clear on what Freddie Prinze Jr., he was supposed to be going somewhere, but then we find out later, nope, he's still stuck back in the hometown
right.
being a fisherman like his dad.
But I guess all of their relationships were strong, too. They were
okay.
paired up, and they were, so everything is good, they're looking good,
right.
they're
the
getting
along.
Right,
the future is bright.
The future's bright. And then this horrible thing happens, they strike a body with their car,
yeah.
and they have a decision to make. You know, they can
right.
either come clean, and then they're guilty of manslaughter, and they speculate, like, all four of them could be, you know, their lives could be ruined.
Yeah.
Or the dude's dead already. Of course, he wasn't, but
they think he is.
They could dump him in the water, and it would be weeks, and any evidence of what happened would be gone.
Maybe his body will wash out to the sea, and no one will even question it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do get that logic. You know, that kind of makes sense in the moment, right? You know, like, well, we have such a good thing going. Do we come clean and tell the truth?
Right.
Or do we just let's sweep this under the rug, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so they make the decision, the fatal decision, to sweep it under the rug.
Right.
And I do think, like, this is a common, you know, movie trope. Can you do this massive sin, right? This thing that's like awful.
Right.
To somebody else. Like, you sinned against another person, like, in a horrible
way. We've murdered someone.
And then can I live life as if it didn't happen? And then, you know, like, because there's lots of things. We all do things that are wrong. We
sure.
all do things that are bad, things that you regret.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, could you murder somebody and then, like, say, you know, say your prayers or whatever, go do your confessional and then move on. Or in this film, what it illustrates is a year later, they all look like crap, first of all.
Yes. I will say that I feel like that's one thing this movie got right.
Uh-huh.
It's like we're fast forwarding a year after this incident, and Jennifer Love Hewitt looks like garbage. She's about to flunk out of her first year of college.
Yeah.
Freddie Prinze Jr.
And her mom asks her, like, are you on drugs?
Yeah, yeah. She's like, are you on drugs? Like, what's going on with you? Something's not right.
Uh-huh.
Freddie Prinze Jr., I don't know what his plans were, but I don't think it was to stay back in his hometown and become a fisherman. Sarah Michelle Gellar, obviously, she was headed to New York. She was going to break out acting, you know, whatever. Yeah. And she's not. She's back home helping run the family store. Not living up to her sister's expectations, clearly.
Yeah.
And then Ryan Phillippe, he was, you know, he is the only one who's like gone off, done his jock thing. He's a quarterback at a school or something. And he's the only one who's like, don't bother me with this. Like, I'm trying to live my life and forget this ever happened.
We don't talk about this.
Yeah.
This is Bruno. We don't talk about Bruno.
We don't talk about Bruno. Exactly. So I feel like that's one thing that the movie did get right is like, you can't just make a massive decision like this in your life.
Yeah.
And then expect everything to go back to normal.
Yeah.
That's not real life. That's not how things happen.
No. This sticks with you.
Ideas have consequences.
Yeah. The guilt, too. The weight of a secret. You know, we had a friend that used to talk about that.
Yeah.
At the end of the movie, of course, they find out that they didn't just hit a random person. They hit a guy that had killed the dude that we saw at the beginning of the film.
Right. So this, let me paint this really quickly.
Yeah, go for it.
So we see at the beginning of the film, this guy who looks suicidal. He's hanging on a cliff edge. He's clearly drinking. He has some sort of memento or token in his hand of something that happens. And then we find out later that he had been the driver in a fatal car accident that didn't kill him, but it killed his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And so the fisherman that's been hunting everyone and killing everyone that they actually hit with their car is the father of the girlfriend that died in the car accident. So it's very
And twisted. He had just murdered the boy. Yeah.
Yes. So when he gets hit by their car, he had just murdered the guy who killed his daughter in a car accident, which, you know, killed his daughter. I'm using air quotes here.
Yeah, manslaughter type situation.
Yeah, it was a manslaughter situation. I don't think the movie even spells out, like, had they been drinking? Was it
reckless they don't drive?
You know, exactly. Like, we don't know, but the boy driver survived, the girl dies, and the girl's father ends up killing him a year later and then gets hit by these four teenagers.
Yeah. And it's such a weight off their shoulders, like, hey, you know, the person that we hit with our car and then we tried to kill, he was a killer.
Yeah, yeah.
So it made it all okay.
It's okay.
I thought it was funny because they just lost their two buddies.
Right, so two of the four have been killed off by this guy.
Yeah, and they never really show any kind of remorse or kind of they never mourn those two.
Nope.
But they're just kind of relieved, you know. And maybe that's true. Maybe that's really true. Like the weight of that secret, the weight of this guilt that I had killed somebody.
Right.
It's like, well, we didn't kill anybody, first of all. And second of all, the person we hit with a car and we tried to drown was a murderer.
Yeah, he murdered somebody else. So we're good. We're
good.
We're scot-free.
So they're absolved of all guilt, you know.
Which is just crazy to think of. Like, that's not how humans work. You still hit someone with your car, thought they were dead, and then dump their body in the bay or whatever it is you live on. Yeah. No, that's going to stick with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, Jeff, it's time for final summations. Is this a yay or a nay for you?
Okay, well, this is a conditional yay.
Okay.
So the condition is that if you want to watch a slasher film, a horror film, and you don't want to be like subjected to gore or, you know, like really nasty violence.
Right.
Like things that like typically compose a slasher film. Like this doesn't really have a lot of that.
No. Yeah, for sure.
You know, you don't have a lot of gore, you know, the sex is happening, but it's like off screen. in the very beginning of the movie, like there's none of like no nudity or anything like that.
No, I was gonna say there's not a sex scene. Yeah, okay.
It really is kind of a PG-13 film if they hadn't thrown in those F-bombs.
Right.
So I think it's kind of a safe slasher film. Like if you want to just test the waters and check it out.
Okay.
I think it's fine. I think too the movie is entertaining. There's the jump scares that get you. If you want a little bit of a thrill, you know, I've watched some other people talk about this movie as far as like how they feel about it. And a lot of people feel like this is a guilty pleasure.
Huh. You okay.
know? So, yeah, I would say it's a yay, but, you know, kind of a conditional yay.
Okay. So mark this down, everybody, because I think this is the first time Jeff did something equivalent to my meh.
Yeah.
When I give a movie a meh.
Right.
I think that's your meh.
That's my meh. Yeah.
Okay. All right. My final summation, I mean, I agree with you. If you want a slasher movie light, mm-hmm. then sure, watch this. If you want a jump scare, like it's Halloween or it's October, and you just need a jump scare without a lot of the ugh that comes with
yeah.
most slasher movies, then this is your movie.
Yeah.
Right? But on the flip side of that, like, does this evoke great deep conversations? Because, you know, that's what I'm going for, right?
Right.
I mean, there are some conversations to be had here, like, especially the one of, like, you know, if you make a decision to cover up a big lie, does it affect the rest of your life? I think there right. is a conversation to be had there. Does this movie do a great job of exploring that? So right. I think this gets a meh for me, yeah. right? Like, if you just want a semi-clean jump scare movie, this is your thing. Is this going to, like, stick in your memory forever as, like, something that provoked great conversation, great discussion? Maybe not.
Right, right.
Maybe not. I'd honestly, like, I couldn't even remember exactly how it panned out until I watched it again.
Right.
So I think that says something for it.
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. Now, is it a summer guilty pleasure? I mean, it is called I Know What You Did Last Summer. So
yeah.
yeah, I think this definitely falls into guilty pleasure.
Yeah, guilty pleasure. It's kind of yeah. horror light, you know, exactly. slasher light.
Exactly.
Well, we did have some comments on our Instagram.
Okay.
You know, one of our followers, least worst option, which is a great
Wait,
handle.
Least worst option.
Yes.
okay. I like that.
Not a fan of 90s slashers, but Jay Hugh redeemed a lot.
Oh, Jennifer Love Hewitt.
Yeah.
Jay Hugh. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I did read where, like, they'd wanted her to do nude scenes or whatever, and then she refused. So they said, hey, we're going to throw you in some outfits that low cut, you know, basically tease the audience.
Sure, sure. I can see that. Well, good for her for having standards. I appreciate that. I will say I heard some clips of her lines, like, separate from the movie. So I wasn't seeing the visuals of the movie. And I just don't love her voice.
Oh, really?
For a serious film.
Okay.
Her voice has something kiddish about it.
Okay.
You know, what is the thing our youngest keeps watching or keeps something he keeps playing and we hear this little voice. Oh, no, it's a commercial on something he's watching. Uh-huh. And it's like the, is it Stonyfield Farms?
Something like that. Yeah.
Where
yeah,
the
I know
lady
what you're talking about.
Is like, has like such a cartoonish voice.
Yeah.
And I won't say Jehu, as this person has called her, has a cartoonish voice, but it's right on the edge of that.
Yeah.
So when you hear her lines separated from the visuals of the movie, I was like, oh, you sound like a little kid cartoon character.
Yeah. No, I can see that.
I mean, and your voice is your voice. Like, what can she do about that? I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, meh.
Meh. Okay. The Film Theorist says, love this film from screenwriter Kevin Williamson, who wrote Scream, and went on to write The Faculty, which Mike talked about last
week. Oh, yeah. We episode. Have not seen that.
And Dawson's Creek for TV.
Oh, that makes sense.
It was a hot screenwriter at that time. Great homage to slasher films with a little bit of a different twist and moral dilemma story than your average horror fare. Good stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can appreciate the moral dilemma there.
Yeah. And we spent some time on that. I do think that's a, you know, what would you do? Right. You know, right. Hopefully you would make the right decision. You'd go to the cops. And had they, just thinking back, if they had made the right decision, they would have gone to the cops.
Right.
The cops would have showed up. They would have figured out this guy's not dead. They would have done
exactly
their investigation and figured out this bad guy had killed this boy that night.
Exactly.
If they'd done the right thing, it would have worked out great.
Do the right thing. That's all I'm saying. People, do the right thing. You know, from living with me, I'm a black and white person.
That's right.
Like, I would have been, Jennifer Love Hewitt needed to grow a spine.
Yeah.
If you want me to really get into the nitty gritty of this movie.
She was kind of the moral person in this movie. Exactly. But she didn't put her foot down enough.
She is the like smart, intelligent, going to whatever college. Like, stand up and say, we don't know if this guy's dead. We're not medical professionals. Let's call. And I get it. This is kind of just pre-cell phone, right? So they didn't have phones on them where they could call 911. But your buddy Max just showed up. Tell him to go get an authority. Like, we need help.
Right.
But no, we got to cover it all up.
One other interesting thing. I watched an interview with Jennifer Love Hewitt on YouTube talking about their iconic scene is when she does this little twirl and she's like, what are you waiting for?
Oh, yeah. It was after that. Like, her right trunk is empty. She's in the road. Like, what do you want from us?
Yeah. She talks about, like, there was a kid or some guy, random guy, that had won a contest to be, like, on the movie set.
Oh, really?
And he had given the suggestion to, like, you know, because he had heard what was happening. It was like, have her do this. Like, what are you waiting for? You know, because if this scene had just happened, that guy's clearly still around there and he's watching.
Right. Well, and you know what? She says in her dialogue right then, I think is a point where she's like, we can't go to the cops. Clearly, this guy has the upper hand.
Yeah.
Like, we can't go to the cops now. He knows exactly what we've done. He knows exactly what's happening. He has the upper hand. And that's why she starts yelling, like, what are you waiting for?
Yeah.
Like, just, you know, whatever.
And it's kind of one of those iconic scenes from this movie.
That's true. That is true.
So what are we watching in our next episode?
Okay, so if I Know What You Did Last Summer was a guilty pleasure, we're going to stick in that vein, and we're going to watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer from 1992. It is PG-13, and IMDb tells us a flighty teenage girl, Buffy Summers, learns that she is her generation's destined battler of vampires.
Very cool. And you're talking about the movie, not the TV show.
We are talking about the movie. It came up in our discussion as we were talking about I Know What You Did Last Summer, and we were talking about this being kind of a guilty pleasure summer movie, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer just seems to fit right in that niche.
Cool. So no Sarah Michelle Gellar. Who's the Buffy in this?
No, Christy Swanson plays the Buffy in the original movie.
Cool.
Yeah.
No, I've never seen this one. And you have.
So we're doing two in a row of movies that Kim has seen that Jeff has not.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
All right. Well, enjoy your movie watching. We will talk to you later.
That's right. Enjoy your movies, guys. Peace out.